Cultures of Compromise, an interview series conducted during the International Conference History and Theory of Compromise in June 2023, organized by the joint research project Cultures of Compromise. Interview with Professor Daniel Weinstock, conducted by Nadine Hennen and Mathis Knospe.
In today's interview, we talk to Daniel Weinstock at the International Conference History and Theory of Compromise. He's a marvelous researcher at the McGill University in Montreal. In this interview, he will talk us through his thoughts on compromise and his research connected to it. The International Conference History and Theory of Compromise brings together a wide range of scholars from different disciplines to discuss compromise. With what expectations did you travel to this conference, and were you already able to take away initial insights for your personal research on compromise?
My thinking has already been extremely stimulated by some of the richness in terms of understanding the very different contexts that give rise to the sense that different actors may have, sometimes political actors in government, sometimes private actors who are trying to get over a private disagreement about property. What are the contextual features that push people towards compromise rather than something perhaps more strategic, more of a winner-take-all kind of logic? Is it something that they feel constrained to do, or is it something that they do willingly because they don't want to place themselves in a situation of domination relative to, say, a neighbor? I think that a lot of the talks that we've heard now, whether the authors thinking about these conceptual questions or not, really show us that we have to go into, there's no one answer that we can give to these questions. It really depends on the specific situation that we find ourselves in, culturally specific, historically specific, and also specific as to the nature of the disagreement over which compromise is being sought.
Compromise may not have the best of reputations. Sometimes it's seen as a burden, an unsatisfactory solution, or a failure of original plans. What do you think could put compromise in a better light? And are there possible alternatives to regulate conflicts effectively?
Yeah, I think there are two reasons that you might have for having a negative view of compromise. One of which, in certain circumstances, I think is quite justified. Sometimes we compromise with things that we shouldn't compromise with. So in my own work, I've tried to identify the limits to compromise. The other reason, the second reason, is I think to do with the fact that when we compromise, we don't win. We feel like we had an objective and we came somehow short of that objective. There, I think that we can do some work in giving compromise a better reputation, that in the long run, a better society in which we try to move away from a winner-take-all logic and move towards one in which, even if we are in a position to get everything we want in a conflict, we choose not to do so and we try to give the other side some of what they want as well. After all, when we think about conflicts that arise or disagreements that arise in a society, Canada, Germany, whatever, we're talking about people with whom we are joined for the long run. And so I think that the nature of the agreements that we reach in the short run will have an impact on the way in which our relations develop afterwards. And I think we just do better if we show ourselves willing to compromise.
To which extent is the concept of compromise accepted in your country? And within the country of your research, how is compromise seen by politicians or the population?
So one of the questions that's been raised here, and I think it's a very interesting one, is that sometimes compromises happen, but we don't name them compromises. So there's the word and then there's the concept. Now, I think that the word compromise perhaps doesn't get used as much as it should in Canada, but I think that it's a country that's entirely based on compromise. I mean, it's a federation like Germany is, and so I think federations, by definition, need to function on the basis of compromises, because you have federated entities with a lot of powers that could really block the evolution of the country if they chose to be uncompromising. In Canada, we have a particular sort of fracture within the country, which is the Quebec-Canada, English-French divide. So Quebec, which is the province that I live in, is the not just the province, but it's also the national homeland of Quebecois people. It's not just one of 10 provinces. Now, in 1982, we had our new constitution, and we tried and failed to find a way of expressing that difference that Quebec has within the constitution. So to this day, so 41 years later, Quebec has still not signed the 1982 Canadian Constitution, which you might think is a catastrophe, but in fact it isn't, because there has been a practice of compromise that has arisen between Canada and the federal government, the other provinces in Quebec. For example, when the federal government has a program in some area within its competence, it will always have a first negotiation with Quebec about whether Quebec wants to join the program. And if not, it gives Quebec the money that corresponds to its share of the taxes that were put into so that it can develop its own analogous policy. So this has happened in the area of, for example, childcare. There's a scholar, a political scientist who became a minister of the government for a while by the name of Stéphane Dion, who has a lovely phrase where he says that Canada is a country that works in practice but not in theory. And I think that that's very right. And the practice has very much been one of compromise.
Can you tell us more about your research on compromise and trust, and how do you see these concepts intersecting?
Right. So I think that compromise almost always occurs in a context which is not necessarily extremely auspicious for compromise, which is a situation of power imbalance. It's almost never the case that two parties that are locked in a disagreement are exactly symmetrically situated. And so we also always have to ask the question, in the context of an asymmetry, what is going to keep the stronger party from just pushing its advantage to the maximal degree? And I think that the concept of trust is an important one in understanding that relationship. I think that above and beyond whatever conflict two parties are locked in, there has to be some kind of a belief that everybody shares, specifically the more powerful party, that we are part of some kind of a temporally extended joint venture, and that there's something about that joint venture that requires that each one of us be able to trust one another to be a kind of a guardian of that joint venture. And that trust is betrayed when one side all of a sudden says, no, no, we're just going to push for the maximum because we can. At the end of the day, international disagreements get settled by maybe not violent force, but by considerations of balance of forces, balance of power.
How do you think trust can be built or rebuilt in situations where it has been broken? And what role does compromise play in that process?
Let me start by saying that I think there may be some situations that are irremediable, right? Where the breakdown of trust requires, at a minimum, that the nature of the relationship be entirely rethought. So if I may use an analogy, Quebec and Canada, when I was growing up, when I was perhaps a young adult, felt like lovers in a heated quarrel. They were very engaged with one another, disagreed about the nature of the relationship, but nonetheless thought that somehow settling this relationship was very important. I think of a country like the UK right now, and my sense is it's in a very perilous situation where a lot of my Scottish friends, but also judging on opinion polls, seem to view what happened in the last 10 years as a kind of a betrayal, and especially the Brexit vote. There's a sense that being part of Europe was part of the compact which held the UK together, and that the Brexit vote sort of showed that the English, people in England and Wales, actually had a very different view of the nature of the relationship, both of the constituent units to one another and to the broader European context. The UK right now, I think it's in a much more difficult situation economically than Canada is, such that the calculation that the Scots or the Northern Ireland community make may be very different if they were ever given the opportunity again to have, say, a referendum on secession. It's very striking that in Canada we now have constitutional law that allows any province, but in particular Quebec, to hold a referendum on secession, and requires of the federal government, in the case of a clear majority, that it negotiate. Now, the High Court in the UK has just denied that right to the Scots. So that's not a very compromising, you know, that's a very kind of loggerheads kind of logic. I'm pessimistic about what will happen over the course of the next 20 years, in part because the central government, it's not a federation, but the central government has decided to play, as we say in North America, hardball, rather than seeking some kind of way of attenuating the conflict.
How do you think your work on compromise and trust relates to broader issues of social justice and equity, particularly in the contexts where power dynamics are unequal?
You know, I used to think that economic conflicts were easier. I've changed my mind about that because I think that in large measure values are at stake in what seem to be economic or social policy issues just as much as in the ones where the values are perhaps more evident at first glance. Now, I think that when you look at the debates over universal basic income, it looks like a technical question about how to distribute the fruits of collaboration. But in fact, when you dig just a little bit, you see very, very deep disagreements, in effect, about the nature of the relationship between work and resources. To what degree is it the case that there's a moral connection between, you know, you only get what you work for? To what degree should we start thinking about degrowth that might be imposed upon us by the rise of artificial intelligence, that might be imposed upon us by climate change, to the extent that we're going to have, as a result of the combined effect of these two huge forces? I used to think there are two kinds of compromise. There's a compromise where we have to talk about our values, and then there's a compromise where we can just count. And now I think that it's all in the value camp.